Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, April 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Dr. William Sarcino, podiatrist with offices in Greenwich, New York, and Bennington, Vermont, providing care and surgery for the foot and ankle, 802-442-2034. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, a general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. Dr. Barsoom specializes in robotic and minimally invasive surgery, hernia repair, gallbladder disease, lipomas, appendix disease, and acute care surgery. Have a question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or email voxpop at wamc.org. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and we're joined today by Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, a general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. Dr. Barsoom practices at Ellis Hospital. She specializes in robotic and minimally invasive surgery, hernia repair, gallbladder disease, lipomas, appendix disease, and acute care surgery. She received her medical degree from Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. She completed a general surgery residency at Valley Health Systems, in Las Vegas, and did her undergrad studies at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. You want to get in the conversation? Call now. There are some open lines. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
You know, I have doctors on this show every week, and for a long time I said, oh, it's very glamorous. But you just told me you've been working seven straight days. How glamorous can that be?
Oh, it's very glamorous. It keeps me busy. It keeps me excited. It keeps me happy. I like helping my patients. I like taking care of people. I like making people feel better. So if the sacrifice is 7 days on call, that's a small sacrifice to make.
But you'll get a day off eventually, right?
Eventually.
Okay. Well, this is a very light lift for you. All you have to sit down and answer some questions, and then you're done. So, you know, it'll be all right. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. General surgery, which means you do lots of different stuff. What have you been doing lately?
I do. And that's really what I enjoy about being a general surgeon is that I get to have different things every single day. You never know what every consult is going to bring. You never know what each patient's story is going to bring. But, you know, some days I'm taking out an appendix. Some days I'm taking out a gallbladder. Some days I take out a colon. Some days I open up a big abscess, which can also be satisfying and very relieving for some patients.
So we'll get to the gallbladder in a minute. The hernia surgery, not the hernia surgery, we'll get to that in a minute as well. The appendix surgery is fascinating. Now, I've had a burst appendix decades ago, and I was in surgery a long time, and I was also recovering in the hospital for about 10 days after the surgery. What do you do? Why is it more difficult to take out an appendix that is already perforated as opposed to one that is intact? Why is it more difficult?
Well, you know, the appendix lives right outside of your right colon. It attaches itself to the colon. So the appendix surgery is actually very unique in that a appendix that is just mildly inflamed can actually be done through three small incisions called laparoscopic appendectomy. And in doing that, you just pick up the appendix, for lack of a better word, cut the attachments around it and take it out. An appendix surgery can take anywhere between 20 minutes and 3 to 4 hours. When the appendix becomes very inflamed, however, you can't really cut anything out. You have to cut its surrounding tissue as well, which would include colon, which would include small intestine, could include, you know, a lot of dissection around that area, because as the body tries to fight off the infection, it actually tries to cocoon it off or bury it within its normal tissue in order to help the body not spread the infection. So,
oh, I see. So the longer you let it go, the worse it can be.
Oh, absolutely. The longer you let it go, the bigger the operation might be. It might end up being an open surgery where there's a big incision down the abdomen and cutting out pieces of colon. I've certainly been in that boat several times, and it could get very complicated.
when you do a first of all, what does a gallbladder do? Does anybody even know today? And then, how difficult is it? I know people who have gone in the same day and they're out, and there's no difference. They eat the same things and everything else.
So the gallbladder is just a storage bag. Your liver makes a substance called bile, sends it to the gallbladder for storage, and then whenever you eat something, especially something a little bit on the fattier side, you need a substance to help digest it. So bile is basically the soap of the human body. It helps break down the fats. So whenever you eat it, it sends a signal to this gallbladder to squeeze out some bile that is stored in there and then to help digest it.
Is that a tough one to remove?
It's tougher than the appendix sometimes, I have to say. I actually just did a couple of gallbladders over the last couple of days, and some of them can be quite challenging because it can there's a lot of structures in the area where you take out the gallbladder. There's a lot of intestines, there's connections. The liver is certainly such an important organ in that area that you have to be very careful not to injure.
What's the toughest area of the inside of the body that you have to deal with on a regular basis? Most difficult, that is.
Most difficult sometimes to see is sometimes inside the pelvis itself. So sometimes it's a little bit difficult. Let's say if someone has diverticulitis and I have to take out a piece of their colon and the colon, you know, runs down into the pelvis. Sometimes it's difficult to get a dissection around that area because, again, there's other structures like the ureter, and there's a lot of veins and nerves and arteries in that area. And sometimes you just can't see deep down.
Well, you know, it always amazes me that people like you go into surgery, as to me, it is such a terrifying concept. When did you realize that, okay, Dr. Randa Barsoom is my future? I am going to be a surgeon. All the dangers be damned, I'm doing this. When did that happen?
I feel like I've had a calling in my heart since I was probably a child, and my mom would tell you probably since I was 6 or 7, whenever anyone asked, they would say, what do you want to be when you grow up, Rhonda? And I would say, oh, I'm going to be a doctor like Daddy. My dad's an emergency medicine doctor. I didn't know what that meant.
Did he say, yeah, go for it, or did he say, don't do that?
For a while, he actually was saying, you know, it's a very difficult road, because it is. You know, it's 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency. So by the time you can even do anything on your own, you're already in your beginning to mid-30s. So it's difficult. It's different from other specialties or other careers, I should say. But I never wavered. I always wanted to be a doctor. And then in medical school, I realized that I have such great joy being in the operating room. You know, the whole world melts away when you're in the operating room.
You don't get scared. You don't get nervous.
Not outwardly. A lot of times I'm scared.
But you take joy from this. So this must put you in the happy place.
It makes me very happy when someone comes in, let's say with an appendicitis. And an appendicitis can lead to sepsis and can lead to death. And when that same person can leave the hospital maybe 1, 2, or 3 days later without their appendix and live a completely normal life and never have to think about this again.
We're joined today by Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, a general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And this email came in from Laura in Sheffield. And then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones, etc. She says, do you know about a surgery that removes the gallstones from the gallbladder, but not the gallbladder itself?
Generally, that's not very recommended.
Why?
It is recommended to just take out the gallbladder. Anytime you open up the gallbladder to empty out stones, you worry about leakage of the stones out of the gallbladder. You worry about continuing to form stones, which eventually can actually block that connection between the gallbladder and the intestines, which what leads to an emergency surgery. But generally, we just take out the whole gallbladder. We find it less morbid than to try to attempt any other procedures.
You can't do ultrasound and dissolve
it? You can't, unfortunately.
Why?
I'm sure there are
research.
You can do that
with kidney stones, right?
That is true. There are certain procedures that you can break down kidney stones, but there aren't the same really procedures for gallbladders that are commonly used. There is rumors of things that are trying to be used, and there's also medications that some people have tried to use to decrease the size of their gallstones, but it's not common practice, especially in America, especially with a procedure that we have done for so many years and have now perfected and minimally invasive.
You know, I mentioned this earlier. A buddy of mine years ago had his gallbladder out, and he was out in short order. I don't know if it was that day or the next day, and I said, well, how has your eating changed? He said, no, I can eat everything I want now.
Most people have no real repercussions after their surgery. As long as the surgery itself goes well, most people sometimes may have some bowel changes over the next 1 to 2 weeks as the body adjusts to just not having that storage of bile. But most people just forget that their gallbladder even came out. All they see is a couple of little scars on their belly.
Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us today for Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll take a quick break here, and then we'll get back to the emails and the calls. We'll be back. Adventures in Radio await you right after this program. Our fearless news director, Ian Pickus, and Sarah LeDuc will be up in, they're there now, at Tupper Lake, New York, at the Adirondack Sky Center and Observatory, because there's this eclipse happening. And I'm getting tired of hearing about the eclipse. So let's lance that boil and do a full-hour show while the totality happens up at Tupper Lake. Anyway, it's going to be really cool. They've been preparing for this show for some time. 3 to 4 p.m. on WAMC right after Medical Monday. Number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have a question that a general surgeon can answer, feel free. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. How has robotic surgery changed? Well, you're fairly young. You probably grew up with robotic surgery. But how does it make your job easier? And is there a time when it doesn't make your job easier?
Yeah, absolutely. So robotic surgery is it's a blessing and sometimes can be a little bit of a curse, you know. So the robot was initially created for that difficult place that I told you about, which is the pelvis. It was created for these surgeries where it's difficult to get your hands in, but you can get a camera inside and you can get these instruments that have the same mobility as your wrists inside without actually having your own wrists inside the pelvis. And that's what's great about the robot, and that's what makes it different from laparoscopic, where laparoscopic surgery is almost like, you know, it's like almost like chopsticks. You're operating without the mobility of the arms, whereas the robot can rotate 360 degrees and show you everything you need to see. The robot makes things like gallbladder surgeries, I believe, a lot easier. There's also settings on the camera itself that can change and show you things like the connection system between the gallbladder and the intestines just because of a dye that you can give a patient. The gallbladder, you can also see right around it with these cameras that can also turn corners, really, to show you what goes on. In addition, my console that I'm sitting at operating on the robot gives me 3D vision inside the abdomen. So it's like I've become basically Ant-Man and you've dropped me inside an abdomen.
Now, when you were a kid, were you allowed to play video games?
I was.
Okay. Do you think that helped you?
I wish that I played more video games. I feel like I would have been maybe even better of a robotic surgeon. There are actually studies that link people who have played video games a lot as children to better robotic and laparoscopic surgeons.
So interesting. Our guest today is Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, a general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery. You mentioned it also can be a curse. Why?
Because I feel like sometimes we rely on these robots a lot of times, and especially in a lot of training programs, they rely on these minimally invasive techniques to try to minimize incisions and minimize pain after surgery, that the art of a open surgery, the art of being able to feel with your hands what exactly you need to dissect can sometimes go away. And I feel like that is such an important, crucial thing to be a general surgeon, just to be able to feel what you're doing with your own fingertips.
And of course, you learned all of that. I mean, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency. So you've done it the old-fashioned way,
oh,
and you
absolutely.
Still do. What extra training did you have to do to become proficient in robotic surgery?
So the robot is actually in two components. There is someone at the bedside actually changing instruments with the robot arms. The robot surgeon is not, in fact, at the bedside of the patient. They are on a console in the same room, but not at the bedside of the patient. They are controlling the robot arms away from the patient. So
you're not even looking at the patient?
I am looking at the patient, but I'm looking more inside the patient because my camera can show me everything I need inside. but there has to be someone trained also at the bedside of the patient. So the first thing to learning how to be a good robotic surgeon is learning how to be the bedside person as well, learning how to troubleshoot all the different arms and all the different instruments. And after you become proficient at this, then you sit at the practice console and you do practice simulations. They don't just let you do surgeries on a human being before you practice a lot on a simulator. And then you can, you know, hop on the actual robot and learn to do simple procedures, you know, simple suturing, simple dissections. And it takes a lot of years, and you actually have to be certified by both your program as well as Intuitive or Da Vinci, the company that makes the robot.
That is so fascinating. And I think this is a point that I just want to bring up before we go to the phones. 800-348-2551. You mentioned sort of the information and the feel you get, the art of what you do. Can be gleaned from tactile. You're feeling things
right.
In an open surgery. You don't get that feedback in robotic surgery, but you get extra information, maybe visually. Again, you got angles that you can't see from the outside. Does it change patient outcomes ultimately, going from open surgery to robotic surgery?
Statistically,
yeah.
No difference.
Really?
There is a difference, however, in patient length of stay and as well and pain. So if you can imagine an open surgery. So, for example, the old way to do a gallbladder surgery is to make a large incision on the abdomen, going through muscle, going through tissue, going through fat, and closing up all of that again, a lot of times with staples and sutures. It took forever to heal. Whereas a lot of my gallbladder patients are usually home within 24 hours.
That's amazing.
And within 2 days, they can go back to their normal life, really. You know, most of them, when I see them in my office about 10 to 14 days after surgery, they say, I've already gone back to work, or I've already, you know, picked up my kids from school, or I've already gone to this. Or one of them says, you know, doc, I know you told me not to go to the water park, but I already took my kids to the water park last week. So it's pretty incredible how much smaller the incision that you have to make is, and, you know, get the visualization a lot of times that you need.
Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us today, general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery from Ellis Hospital. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. You mentioned suturing.
Hmm.
And I promise we'll go right to you first, Laurie in Schenectady. Just hang in there one more minute. Are there macros on some of these? In other words, can you say, okay, time to suture up, and just basically the robot knows what to do and sutures?
Absolutely not.
Really?
Everything is still very much controlled by the surgeon, and that's why the surgeon has to be very trained in every form of surgery, both open, laparoscopic, and robotic. The robot does not act on their own in any way. The robot is actually a pretty big misnomer because it doesn't have a brain.
Well,
it is an extension of my own arms. So whatever I do, the robot replicates in the body, but it cannot do anything on its own.
So you can't press a button, suture time, bam, done.
Unfortunately, no, but then I'd be out of a job, and that's
okay.
Not good.
Well,
I love my job.
We don't want that, yes. All right, probably have some medical school bills to pay.
Oh, absolutely.
Unless they get wiped away, and you never know. The number, that's another show. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom is our guest. Laurie in Schenectady, you're on. Oh, that's a bad start. Hello, Laurie.
I'm 70 years old. I have some complications. I'm facing a hernia mesh failure surgery at Ellis, actually. And the question is robotics or not robotics. So could you give me the pros and cons of that, please?
Absolutely. Hello, Lori. I'm sorry you're having some complications.
Hi.
The robotics is actually really great, especially if the mesh is. Did you have this procedure done open before with a big incision?
No, through my navel, no.
Okay, so the robot actually offers a great view into the area where the mesh would be placed, and would be a great way to look inside that area. But I would highly recommend that you speak to your surgeon about this, to find out if this mesh is actually in a great location for the robot to help you out. Because sometimes, like I said, the robot is not always needed. And sometimes a good old-fashioned open approach is sometimes better for something like this.
Okay. Yes, I have been talking to several surgeons and trying to figure it all out.
I certainly hope you do soon, but there's options for hernia repairs for sure.
Lori, thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. General Surgeon Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us. I thought the mesh for the hernias, there was a big controversy about those. Do they still have them?
Absolutely. There is still controversy about the mesh. The meshes that we use recently, especially in the last decade or so, have had larger pore size and have been made from different materials that have actually decreased infection quite a bit. But the company that, you know, Ellis uses especially, and it's actually the same kind of mesh that I use throughout training, it has very, very minimal, if no real infection risk, as long as they are placed in the appropriate location.
I thought there were some surgeries where they moved around after a while, and I thought that was what some of these lawsuits, these ambulance chasers, would be suing about.
Well, you know, there's also technique in how to place certain meshes, and in the way that we place them, they generally should not move out of their locations at all, and the way that we suture them in, too.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom is our guest from Ellis General Surgery. What exactly, thank the good Lord, I have not had a hernia. So what exactly goes wrong, and why do you need a mesh?
Okay. So there's several different kinds of hernias. So as you are developing in utero, so when you're an embryo, you already have some inherent openings where certain things have to grow, basically. So your belly button is one of them. So that's where your placenta comes out of. That's how you get your nutrition in utero. The groins is also one of them, especially in men. This is also where the spermatic cord and vessels come down into the scrotum. So those are inherent weaknesses, we like to call. There are other ways to get hernias. Previous surgery is a great way to get a hernia because you violate the natural abdominal wall fascia, or the thick, or the strength layer, basically, of the abdominal wall. So if it's inherent, or if it's a surgery, sometimes it's a trauma.
Okay, but what the mesh is replacing is this strength layer?
What the mesh is doing is reinforcing the layer. So let's say it's a belly button hernia, which I do a lot of. There is an already inherent weakness or opening in this fascia or strength layer. So what I do is close up that layer, and then the mesh is kind of like a screen door. It helps reinforce it so that, let's say you gain some weight, get pregnant, something happens, you have a lot of pressure inside. At the very least, that layer is then strengthened, kind of like, if you would like to think like a spackle and drywall. You know,
I was thinking Bondo on a car where you put it, where you put the mesh in and then
Bondo,
you put the Bondo
great,
on.
Yeah. That's a great one I should use with patients too.
Yeah, time for some Bondo.
Yes.
I don't think that'll go over that great. Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us, and let's go to Great Barrington. Ken, you're on.
Hi. I was just wondering, what are gallstones and why are they formed? And the other thing was, I recently had shoulder surgery, and the surgeon showed me pictures she took, and I cannot figure out how you can get, it's like the tendon she stitched was in a room and she took a picture of it from a distance. I don't think there's that much room in your shoulder. The camera is just amazing. I can't get over it.
Yeah, these cameras have come a very, very long way from the early days of laparoscopic surgeries too, Ken. I am a very strong believer in how good these cameras can be. But gallstones are actually just a result of diet, unfortunately. A lot of them are made of cholesterol, but we have not actually found a connection that someone has high cholesterol is more likely to have gallstones. But they are just, you know, a combination of the bile that sits in that gallbladder and cholesterol and maybe some calcifications. We can't really stop people from creating them, and we can't really start making guesses as to, you know, who would have more gallstones. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people that we see walking around, especially with the Western diet, are going to have gallstones that they find on imaging, like CAT scan or ultrasound, just incidentally. And they may never have an issue with their gallstones ever. So we still can't guess who's gonna have problems and who's not.
All right, Ken, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Rhonda Barsoom today of Ellis General Surgery. We'll go to Rotterdam. Glenn, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. Got a question, like that, or have the doctor comment on the recent announcement of a kidney transplant done to a patient with a GMO modified, I think it was a pig kidney. Do they modify that with stem cells? Or I don't know if the doctor can comment. I'll hang up.
All right, thanks a lot. Are they cheaper?
I have no idea if they're cheaper. I mean, sorry.
Half dozen, I'll just bank them.
The transplant world has become so advanced in their medications, their where we're trying to, you know, harvest these organs, because obviously we're in such a shortage of organs and there are so many people, unfortunately, on these UNOS lists that we're trying so many different ways and researchers. I did hear about this kidney transplant that was successful, and I'm very, very happy for this patient, but I think that we still have a lot of work to do in terms of that research and perfecting something like this.
All right. Thanks for the call, Glenn. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday, general surgery today with Dr. Rhonda Barsoom. Let's go to Madam Morris, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Why are the edges of the peritoneum not debrided in a hernia operation? I would think this would produce a stronger bond.
The peritoneum is actually very, very thin. It is only a cell or two layer thick. It actually does not produce any real strength layer. It is a good protective layer, and it's also a really good diffusion layer for things throughout the abdominal cavity. But generally, when we do close an abdomen, we will sometimes incorporate the peritoneum, or we most times incorporate the peritoneum in our closure, but it doesn't actually form any stronger of an abdominal closure.
All right, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday with Dr. Rhonda Barsoom. This email from Donna, who's in Poughkeepsie. 15 years ago, I had bariatric surgery and had a lap band put in. I want to have it removed now. Is that something that a general surgeon would do?
That is something that we are trained to do for sure during our residency. However, my highest recommendation is to present to a bariatric surgeon, as they do this for a living. And bariatric surgeons are actually quite phenomenal in coming up with different options for the best weight loss surgeries, as well as reversing things like lap bands.
Now, what's a lap band?
A lap band is basically like a belt that we use to place around the stomach to decrease its size so that it gives the sensation that someone is full faster. We have not done a lot of lap bands in recent years because we found that there are some complications with it. And we've also found that things like the sleeve or the bypass have come up greater weight loss in a shorter amount of time.
All right. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And it's general surgery today with Dr. Rhonda Barsoom. Let's grab one more call before the next break. And West Sand Lake, Deanne, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm calling. I hope. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if this is exactly in the area you're all talking about, but one of the people I know I'm talking about did have a hernia surgery. And three people I know now who have come home from the hospital with open wounds. And I never heard about that before. And I'm just wondering what's going on with that.
People coming home with open wounds. Okay.
Well, Deanne, there's a lot of things that happen sometimes in these big hernia surgeries, especially if it's a very big defect that requires a lot of dissection. Sometimes if we are worried about, let's say, if we have to take down a lot of adhesions, for example, inside the abdomen, and if maybe there's, you know, bowel in the way or there's any risk of infection, keeping an open wound is a great way to prevent the infection from accumulating into what's called an abscess cavity or a pus pocket that would need further surgery, that would need drainage, that would need antibiotics. So a lot of times an open wound is a great way to prevent the accumulation of this abscess. And the body does heal it. The body does a great, great job building together the scaffolding of healing that puts it together on its own when, you know, the tissue is ready and infection-free.
Okay, well, then one person, this has gone on for 6 months. She had to actually have another surgery. She had a heart surgery, but she actually had another surgery because of it got infected. So you're saying that's a normal procedure to send people home that way?
It is certainly not normal, but it's not unusual, I should say that.
Right. And every case is different,
right? Absolutely.
All right, Deanne, thanks a lot. We have to take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom is our guest. General surgery today, and we'll be back. Thank you. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Rhonda Barsoom today from Ellis General Surgery. Well, we've been talking about, and I don't want to minimize it, but the littler surgeries, the hernias and the gallbladders and stuff, there are some big ticket items too, yeah?
Absolutely.
What else do you do?
So colons are a little bit more involved than just just hernias, but hernias can get very complicated as well, as we heard recently. But colon resections can also be quite complicated. A lot of times they will require a bigger surgery, especially if it's an emergency. You know, if someone has what's called perforated diverticulitis, which is basically the outpouchings, especially on the left side of the colon, perforating. Patients can get very sick very fast from this and will require a piece of their colon being taken out.
Infection, you mean?
Absolutely.
Okay. So these are little sacs, and they basically pop?
Correct. So if you can imagine how often you drive on your tire, and if you can see your tire has that little outpouchings or the little weaknesses, your colon actually can do the same thing, especially on the left side of the colon. And sometimes just a little bit of a hole in one of those little outpouchings, which are weaker than the normal colon wall, can cause a lot of infection, can cause pus to go around, can cause, you know, fecal, basically, leakage around that area, too. So it can get very bad very fast.
What causes it to perforate?
We used to think that it was your diet. We used to think that a lot of people, you know, they swear by avoiding seeds, for example. They were told that they can't have strawberries because the seeds in the strawberries would cause one of these seeds to get stuck in them. We don't really have great evidence to support what kind of foods prevent something like this from happening. It is unfortunate. Sometimes it happens in very younger patients. You know, I've seen patients in their 30s have something like this done. And I've seen patients who live their whole lives without worrying about it until their 70s. And then all of a sudden they get one of these perforated diverticulitis. And all of a sudden they have to have surgery.
Do you know it if you have it?
Sometimes you'll feel a little pain or discomfort, especially in that left side of your abdomen. But I do highly recommend that if you are 45, you should get a colonoscopy because we'll be able to see those outpouchings in the colon.
But it can go away on its own, yeah?
No.
No?
Once the outpouchings are there, they don't go away. Now, you can get a mild infection of one of those outpouchings that we can treat with antibiotics, and we never have to do surgery on them. And there's a lot of people who get these episodes once a year, once every couple of years, and we'll give them antibiotics, and they never go through with the surgery, which is actually the more common approach. The surgery is really reserved for someone who has had this for multiple episodes or has a bad infection because of it.
Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us today on Medical Monday of Ellis General Surgery in lovely Schenectady, New York. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll go back to the phones in a minute. A couple of emails. This is, let me make sure I can read this. Oh, all right. This is from James. I didn't make this up. You go ahead. There's a rumor in and around the medical field that surgeons don't necessarily have the best bedside manner. Pediatricians, for example, have the exact opposite reputation. Such stereotypes are even portrayed and reinforced by TV, medical dramas. Would you say that there's some truth to these rumors?
I would say that's a great stereotype. I would hope that my patients, as well as the patients of my partners, feel otherwise. We do take great care to not only know you as a person, but know everything about you medically. So I personally like the, you know, how my program taught us how to treat our patients, which is to pull up a chair and sit down and have a conversation. Learn who you're talking to as a person, as a human being, because the person in front of you is not a disease. It's a person.
Let me ask you a question, though. Let's play devil's advocate here for a minute. You got to learn that. That's part of the game. But what if your patient is a nitwit and doesn't want to, doesn't believe what you're saying and doesn't want to follow your orders? How do you deal with that in a diplomatic way?
I believe that every person is allowed to make their own decisions. As long as I am presenting each patient with their risks and benefits and alternatives to every, you know, procedure that I perform, and that they fully understand what I'm saying, everyone is more than free to make their own decisions about their own care. I can understand also having a relationship with your surgeon and your doctor, and building that rapport enough in order to trust this surgeon and doctor that when I tell you that this is important, that you should follow these instructions. But obviously, you know, if someone is not willing to do that, I'm not there to force them. I am there to only do what's best for them.
And you are okay guilt-wise going forward? You say, I did my best?
Certainly no. There's, you know, a lot of guilt that goes into sometimes our job, and in that we always have to think about, could I have done more? Could I have done this differently? Could I have made a different decision? Could I have approached this patient differently or explained it a little bit differently, yeah, perhaps? At the end of the day, you know, I always pray that God gives me wisdom in speaking to these patients and gives me kindness and compassion so that I can listen to what they're not telling me, listening to what their fears are. Sometimes you get these patients who say, you know, their mother died because of surgery or something, or their mother was misdiagnosed for a long time, or their mother had a surgery then had a complication and they are deathly terrified of going under.
Yeah.
That's not something that's that a patient will come out right and talk about. So that's something that the pulling up the chair and having a conversation with the patient brings up.
Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us today from Ellis General Surgery. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to North Adams, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on.
Yes. I've had a liver transplant a couple of years ago, and down in the lower area underneath it, it seems like I get cramps if I try to pull myself up and move a certain way, put any kind of a strain on those muscles down there. I get like a Charlie horse effect. I'm wondering what's causing that.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm happy for you that you got your liver transplant. That's fantastic. Unfortunately,
yeah, everything else is very successful. My blood numbers are great.
That's great. Yeah, you know, a liver transplant, unfortunately, is not a surgery that we can do minimally invasive, and this is, goes back to what I was saying, that those big incisions, they cut through muscle and they cut through nerves, and you know, the structure really of the abdominal wall is compromised for a short while. So
right.
It's not always unusual to have these kind of cramps and muscle spasms, especially because of, you know, the fact that we have to cut through these muscles. I would suggest that you definitely speak to your doctor about that. There are medications that can help with muscle spasm and nerve pain, especially in that area. And there are medications that, you know, can be not even pills. It can be just topical creams and patches and things like that. So definitely speak to your doctor about something like this.
Dan.
Yeah, it doesn't come on by itself. It's always when I put a stress on it, like sitting up from a reclined position.
I was always wondering
if it might be like scar tissue.
It could be. 2 years is about the right time where scarring is going to definitely form. Unfortunately, I you know, definitely talk to your surgeon,
right,
but I would not recommend trying to go back and cut anything else because, you know, the more someone goes into your abdomen, the more scar tissue is actually going to form.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot for the call. So when you do open surgery, you just said it, you'll have to cut through sometimes bone, muscle, nerves. Do nerves grow back, though?
At a very, very, very small rate. I tried most of our surgeries, we don't actually cut through a lot of nerves. There are some nerves that innervate like the skin and the abdominal wall. Like a lot of people, especially after certain breast surgeries, will say, you know, I feel numbness around this area just because the nerves of the skin don't really, you can't really do anything but sacrifice them, unfortunately. They can grow back very, very slowly, but unfortunately some people just continue to have this kind of numbness or feeling. They always tell us it's like feeling your skin through a sock.
Weird.
Yeah.
Dr. Rhonda Barsoom is our guest today from Ellis General Surgery. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Jeff is in Johnsonville. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I was diagnosed, I have a bunch of stones in my pancreas, and I also get kidney stones quite frequently. I was wondering, should I be concerned about the stones in my pancreas?
That's interesting. I haven't really heard of stones in the pancreas as much. Are we sure there are stones?
Yeah, they're all like calcifications.
Okay, so a little calcifications.
That's what the doctor said.
Okay, so calcification. I would definitely speak to your GI doctor about this. This can be a result of other things going on, perhaps in your medical history or your diet, but they should look for other reasons why this is caused. Kidney stones sometimes are, you know, a result of, you know, some things that you drink and eat. You know, I have patients who tell me I drink a lot of iced tea and all the salts really in the iced tea cause me to have these kidney stones or a lot of tea. So a lot of patients are actually quite predisposed to getting these stone formations. And sometimes we just would never figure out really why they happen.
Interesting. Jeff.
Huh. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Should I be greatly concerned about the calcifications in my pancreas? So that nothing's bothering me that I think of.
I wouldn't say greatly concerned until you speak to your doctor for sure, because without looking at, you know, the CAT scans and your medical history, it's hard to say what is concerning and what's really not. But definitely speak to a GI doctor about this, please.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom joins us today on this edition of Medical Monday. Bob in Albany writes in, subject heading, this is a big one. You ready? The future of general surgery, ? How are tech innovations, robotics, AI, et cetera, changing the areas of general surgery? What does the future hold for what you do?
I think the future looks very bright. I think that every time we advance in perhaps a robot with more tactical feedback or more haptic feedback or cameras that can show us certain angles or cameras that can show us certain light waves, I think as these things progress, we become better surgeons. I'd like to think that our training is so encompassing of all of the different techniques and all the different body parts that we ourselves actually are become, you know, these jack of all trades, really.
Yeah. Are they experimenting with robotic surgery that offers the surgeon tactical feedback?
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually very excited. I'm heading to the conference in Las Vegas this week.
Oh, lucky
for
you.
Intuitive, who is a great company who has provided us with these wonderful machines. And there is actually, you know, talk a lot about these robots that are going to have haptic feedback and tactical feedback, so that, you know, our biggest complaint about these robots is that you can't really tell sometimes how much you're touching. Although I will say that, you know, after several years of being on the robot or doing hundreds of robotic surgeries, you do get a sense. You do combine your 3D vision with what you're feeling to understand exactly what's going on. Your brain does a great job combining all these senses.
What percentage of your surgeries are open and what percentage are now this new way?
I would say close to maybe 65%.
The new way?
Of laparoscopic and and robotic. Maybe even 70%, I would say. Just thinking about this last week, how many times I actually did open versus a minimally invasive surgery.
The number to call here, by the way, is 800-348-2551. Still time to get your call in, if you will. And, of course, the other part of Bob's question, and we haven't even talked about this at all, once in a while I'll talk about this with a surgeon, and that's artificial intelligence. Mm. That's a sticky wicket, right? Because then you're letting something else make a decision for you.
You know, and that goes back to, is medicine a protocol, or does it depend on both skill and intuition and experience? All of this you can't really teach an artificial intelligence. I think that there are certain things in medicine that can be protocoled. For example, you know, someone's blood sugar is high, you give insulin. It's a certain level high, this is how many units of insulin you give. But I think in the operating room, there is so much that goes into how experienced a specific surgeon is, both in the finesse in of their hands and the art that they perform, as well as what they've seen. You know, sometimes you see different kinds of anatomy, and all it takes is one time you seeing a different anatomy for you to recognize it and build on it. And you can't really teach a robot to do this.
Okay, so in the waning 5 minutes, I'll lay this out there. Is intuition a thing? In other words, in my interactions with the AI chatbot, it's pretty stupid. I mean, it's not intelligence. It's just regurgitating things from a database. But if the database was everything, and if the surgical database had all cases, all known cases and all variations that you have seen and the medical world has seen, does that eliminate intuition from the equation? And then maybe 100 years, these things do it by themselves.
I don't think so. I think that sometimes there are things that you cannot build into a database. For example, walking in to see a patient in the ICU and just knowing by their color, knowing by how they're breathing, knowing just by how they look of how well they are doing. And you can't build that into a database. That just comes from you praying and asking God for wisdom and asking for that intuition and that what we like to call gut feeling. But, at the end of the day, it's just makes it better by how many patients you've seen and how many cases you perform. And that's not something you can even write a code for. How could you?
I don't know. I mean, so many things have happened that I 10 years ago said, well, how can they do that? And they
that's
do
true.
It now. So I honestly, I can't answer that.
I think for a straightforward, like appendectomy, for example, taking out an appendix, I think if the appendix is straightforward and there are no complications, you know, those 20-minute appendectomies that we talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that you can build a code for a robot to go in, find the artery, clip it, and take the appendix off. But what happens if something goes wrong? How does the robot compute that? How does the robot deal with, let's say, if the patient had a different anatomy? I had a patient recently who has a condition called dextrocardia, which means all of his organs are on the opposite side of his body.
What?
So his appendix, I went in his abdomen, his appendix is on the left side instead of the right side. So this patient, if he ever had left-sided pain, we would have to do a CAT scan to figure out. I don't think a robot could factor for something like that.
How common is that?
Not very common at all.
So if they did a brain scan, a waking brain scan, would his right brain be on the left side?
I don't know if it works for the brain, but the heart definitely, you know, turns into the right side rather than to the left side.
That is so weird.
It is very...
So how did that present challenges for you?
For this particular patient, it didn't because I didn't have to worry about it, but I found it very interesting looking through pictures and looking, you know, at the anatomy.
That is really cool. Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, we're almost done here. How much sleep you had in the past week? You worked every day.
No. It's a good fair amount, maybe 5 to 6 hours a night. Still,
really?
It's not bad.
When you're on call, though, that phone rings anytime?
Anytime, day or night.
Doesn't that drive you nuts?
No, I'm used to it. I hope my husband's used to it, too, by now.
Is he a doctor, too?
He's an attorney.
Oh, so you work for a living. I understand. I gotcha.
He's my rock. He's phenomenal. So I feel bad sometimes when my phone wakes him up, to be honest with you, in the middle of the night, and I know he knows the ringtone that goes off when I get paged by the hospital.
Yeah.
So I sometimes feel bad, and I hope that he doesn't resent me for it, but he's been so very supportive of it.
Does it charge you a billable hour every time you wake him up in the middle of the night?
God, I hope not.
No, that would be very, very bad. Well, we're almost out of time here. Anything that you wanted to cover before we wrap it up?
No, I just want to ask everyone who's listening to make sure you're getting your preventative mammograms and colonoscopies. The best way to combat things like cancer is to prevent it. So let's find things early and take care of them early so that we have better treatments in the future.
I like it. Last question, asking for a friend. Now you got me scared about hernias. Is it just an old person thing?
Not at all. I do a lot of hernia repairs on younger people as well.
How young?
You know, a child can have a hernia. You can have a one-year-old with a hernia in their groin. You can, you know, sometimes the belly button hernia never closes, and we do these belly button hernias on 5 or 6 year olds.
Yeah.
So it's not really an old or a young thing. It's just the way God built your body kind of thing.
How do you get them?
In the places where there are inherent weaknesses, a lot of pressure.
Okay, so...
Lifting,
okay.
Pregnancy.
This is great. Okay, thank you for saying that because this is what I tell my wife. I can't lift that. I can't. I'm going to get a hernia.
Well, if you don't have a defect, there's no reason why you shouldn't lift.
Oh, I got plenty of defects, but that's another show. Hey, Dr. Rhonda Barsoom, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. It was lovely being here.
Support comes from Gloversville Sewing Center. Gloversville, a quilt shop offering a selection of fabrics and accessories, including Bernina and Janome sewing machines. A proud underwriter of WAMC for over 30 years. We're worth the trip. GloversvilleSewingCenter.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Rhonda Barsoom of Ellis Medicine for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Fun show. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, who is our engineer. Phone screen today by Bob Rathman. Thank you, Bob. Good job. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we will do surgery on your car with Gordon Fricke. We'll see you, too.